I believe the two most powerful words in business are just ask.
From a base of 200 billion of assets, my target in 5 years was to get us to 300.
We struck the oil in 69, the day before Christmas Eve. On the last attempt, bang, found the oil.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time. And he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. For much of life, the world of banking might seem both impenetrable and dull, yet there are times when it vaults to being center stage, at which point it typically ushers in fear, loathing, and even panic. Despite leaps in technology and financial disintermediation, banks remain at the epicenter of financial flows. They're the lifeblood of modern economies. With the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank on one side of the Atlantic, a previously niche specialist and generally unknown bank, to Credit Suisse, a global behemoth, echoes of 08 have been heard. And to help get our arms around the state of play and understand whether these are isolated events as opposed to indicative of wider frailties, we wanted to find one of the world's top thinkers on the subject and do a special edition, record it and turn it around quickly. And when we asked some of our network who they'd like to hear, one name kept coming back. It was Hugh Van Steenis, vice chair at Oliver Wyman, previously, amongst his other roles in finance, global head of banks and diversified financial research for 14 years at Morgan Stanley, and prior to that, head of diversified financials at JP Morgan. So, Hugh, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Simon, wonderful to be with you, although it's a shame it takes a crisis to get on your wonderful show.
Well, you've seen a fair chunk of crises, as have I, but I've been looking forward to this a lot. I've probably got too many questions, which I'll have to pare back as we go along, but the spark that lit the touch paper began in the US. And I guess let's just start. Are you shocked by the chain of events and by the responses?
I wasn't shocked by the smaller of the two banks which went under, because they had had for at least 6 months worries about crypto malpractice and crypto might bring them down. But no, look, the pace of this is extraordinary. I mean, this is 20 to 30 times faster than anything we saw 15 years ago or in the Eurozone banking crisis. And at the end, history doesn't repeat itself, but human behavior does. And at the end of the day, this does remind you of some past banking crises where you've had a prolonged period of stability, stability bred complacency, a huge shock in interest rates, and a couple of people who are reaching for the top shelf of tipple back over. We should go into it a little bit more, and I'm sure we'll unpack it. But obviously, part of this is the sharpest increase in interest rates in our lifetime, but also it's working through the excesses of the pandemic. So just put some numbers on it. In the States, between 2020 and 2022, there were $5.2 trillion of deposits bunged into the US banking system, only $2 trillion of which were insured. Now, loan growth, as we will remember, was really tepid, so it's about $700 billion of loan growth. So what do you do with the rest? Well, banks put about $1.9 trillion on deposit with the Fed, but bought $2.25 trillion of securities. And obviously, the foolish ones bought long-dated securities. And if we come on to Silicon Bank, effectively, it was a really dumb rates trade which went sour.
And if we reference the history books and look back at the US savings and loans crisis, I believe between 1986 and 1995, a third of those 3,000 institutions went bust. And after that, and following the great financial crisis of 2008, regulators made changes to establish more resilience. But under Trump, there was pushback. Is this where the seeds of this crisis was sown?
Well, look, I think it's great to go back to that early 80s period and probably even dial back a bit earlier. But there's a great book by Bill Black called The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. It's a little bit turgid. It was written by a bank regulator, but some phenomenal insights in it. And he said, look, what made that debacle worse were the three Ds: deregulation, desupervision, and then the decriminalization of white collar crime. And that's kind of what was beneath the SNL crisis. Deregulation, desupervision was on show here. In 2018, the Trump reforms, which were supported bipartisan, rolled back what was a systemic bank from 50 billion to 250 billion. Now, let's put that in context. In the Eurozone, a systemic bank is cut off at 30 billion euros. SVB was the 16th largest bank and yet wasn't subject to Basel stress tests, nor to liquidity coverage ratios. And so sadly, not being in the eye of the supervisor, they had some poor practices.
Which, of course, allows us then to move over to Europe that has had, one might argue, better scrutiny and regulation. And we have Credit Suisse, a poorly run institution for a long time, but suddenly any remaining trust evaporates. Reminds me of Ernest Hemingway's quotation, "How did you go bankrupt?" "Two ways," he answered, "gradually and then suddenly." So tell me, Hugh, what goes wrong?
It's tricky because I think at one level you say there's not much in common between the banks and the states since Credit Suisse. But if you unpick it, there probably is. So first is, in all the cases of the four banks which have failed, and obviously there's another one wobbling at the moment, they were the banks of the billionaires and the VCs. And what we've now found is these are hyper-connected people. They're all sitting on social media. They're all frenzied by what's going on social media and whip their money out. I think that billionaire movement is something which regulators will have to come back and look at. These uninsured deposits moved very fast. And throughout history, it's the uninsured depositors which run. Even in 84, with the largest bank crisis at that stage, Continental Illinois, it was foreign depositors who ran.
Let's just stay with the concept of deposit and deposit protection, because there are siren calls that depositors shouldn't lose money under any circumstances. You've written in the FT the other day about banks needing to be more sensitive to the threat of deposit flight and to pay up for funding, and that that will lead to tightening financial conditions. And I wonder whether you could explain that.
Well, there's a couple of legs to this. Let's go from the end backwards. I think we've just seen the sharpest tightening of financial conditions in history, following the fastest bank run in human history and the fastest increase in interest rates in our lifetimes. And I think that's partly a function of this digital bank run. In the States now, if you're a mid-cap bank, you're really thinking about how many loans you want to give, what's the right price you want to give them, because you're not quite sure of the stability of your funding base. Now, I think in contrast, some of the bigger banks are actually benefiting. They're actually getting excess deposits, hundreds of billions of excess deposits, no doubt. But they're equally going to worry, are these easy come, easy go deposits? So they may not want to make loans either. So I think the financial conditions will sharpen tightly. I think we all disagree about how much. I mean, I think Goldman's is putting in, it's as if financial conditions just tighten 25 to 50 bips. My good friend Torsten Slok, now at Apollo, thinks it's 150 bips. I think the bank nerds like me and, say, Davide Serra are probably more in, it's like a point of increase. But nonetheless, this is a huge hit. In Europe, what we don't know yet is how big a hit it is. I think, though, my conversations with the bank CFOs and treasurers and investors is that they are starting to worry about the cost and availability of funding. So I think financial conditions tighten our side of the pond as well. It comes down, Simon, to the point of how sticky are those deposits and then what you do with it. You run money for a very long while. If you've got daily liquidity money, you don't put it in 10-year illiquid securities. And I guess in a way, it's a classic ALM mistake, which the management of SVB were doing.
And extraordinary that BlackRock had been in there and run their slider all over, presumably using their Aladdin system, which we discussed on previous interviews. And there were all the flaws being sort of highlighted. Maybe it's tough, but is it fair to suggest that that tighter regulatory oversight in Europe means that there is fewer accidents to happen in your mind in Europe than the US?
I think so, but I think there's two lenses on this. So first is, every bank above 30 billion in the Eurozone has stress tests of some sort, and they've got liquidity. The liquidity rules are, could you hold your breath for 30 days with no funding? Doesn't mean that they couldn't, if the waterline went very high, they wouldn't have some issues. but they've got a much bigger gap. And in a way, what happened here is there was a bit of denial by the banks. Let's think, if we did history again, if SVB had raised capital November last year, very different story. So it gives the banks more time to react. That said, the second, though, and I think is much more, again, historical sweep, is if you think about, let's say, Japanese banks 15 years after their crisis, they hadn't made that many loans. There was bugger all speculation. There really wasn't much to go wrong on the asset side. So I think what you find here is, again, 15 years after the crisis, we haven't had the rampant speculation in the Eurozone or the UK that we've seen in the States around the tech sector. Maybe there's a couple of fringes around a bit of commercial real estate, but there isn't the same speculation. On the asset side, I don't think they're the bad debts lurking quite in the same way that we've seen through this big rate shock.
Well, we might come back to the valuation situation and opportunity later on, but I just want to stay with this sense of the stronger getting even stronger. Is there almost now an oligopoly of the super banks? And from that might flow super profits because you're worried about where you go. Therefore, your choice has diminished to a very small number.
Yes, but I think we were already creating a super league of banks anyway out of the last financial crisis. Take the top US banks. Pre-financial crisis, they used to represent about 20% of industry profits. They now represent over 60% of industry profits. So I think that partly is a function of the regulation giving them a moat, and therefore they're viewed to be safe and secure. But I think there's something else which you've discussed on previous pods, which is around the role of technology. The more that technology becomes an important source of competitive advantage for a bank, how you serve your clients, the more that winner takes most characteristic you see in tech is starting to come to banks. So the profitability of the top three banks is way higher than even the next three or the three after that. So I think that winner takes most is playing out in banking. And I think that has really helped the Super League in the States.
But if we play that forward, we all remember Glass-Steagall divided banks from their banking activities, from their investment banking activities. That was all sort of rescinded. And now we have these super banks that are doing all of those activities. Where's the risk there? And what happens should one see human behavior again?
I think this is where it comes down to bank by bank. So look, the history of banking would also suggest you need diversification. So at least with some of these super banks, they are well diversified between banking businesses and fee income businesses, US, non-US, and so forth. Obviously, the tragedy for CS was it wasn't diversified enough and it wasn't earning enough. I think the quid pro quo will be regulators will be on their case even harder. They'll be focusing even more on the amount of capital and liquidity they have. Some would argue that banks are a public-private partnership. I think it's a bit too far myself. But at the end of the day, they will need to be incredibly well supervised. So no, look, there will be a pound of flesh for the big banks, no doubt too.
I am older than you. When I started, the banks were, if not utilities, they were viewed through a lens of rather dull with a yield and cyclically sort of exposed, but you bought them below value, etc. But now it seems that we've moved into a different environment where super profits might be available, concentrations happened, and I don't want to go from the money maze to the moral maze, but are we in a situation where the profits are being privatized, but the risks are being socialized?
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. So with the reforms of the last 15 years, a huge amount of the risk-taking activity has moved out of the banks and into the private equity world, hedge fund world, specialist players. And if you think about the value creation in the last 5 years, it's been in people on your show. It's the KKRs and Blackstones, it's the stock exchange groups and so forth. So I think there's a lot of activities have actually moved out. And again, diversity is strength. The fact we've got a pluralistic system, you can go to get money from a bank or BlackRock or a private equity firm is obviously very helpful. What that means then is that what's left in the banks is a lower margin business. And of course, that means you do need scale. And I think that's the challenge, that the more scale you need, that's why the super leagues, the top three, top five, disproportionately benefit, not just because of their diversification, because in a lower margin business, you need that scale. So in a way, the scale is also a function of public policy rather than just because of greedy bankers.
Okay, I understand that's right. And we were never called that to you, so that's absolutely fine. But you're right. We've had Bain Capital talk about their private credit business. We understand this disintermediation impact, probably since the great financial crisis, a reluctance from a lot of banks to lend as they would have lended. Now, if the central bankers can ring fence the commercial banking system, they can contain certain amount of risk. But with so much having moved into the shadow banking system, and I sit on a couple of asset allocation committees, and private credit is an asset class that exists that never existed. What's the chance that, in fact, the problem next shows up there and that becomes very difficult for the regulators?
First, banks are different because they're leveraged. As you see, whatever shock you have, even though post-reforms, the amount of equity capital in the banking system has tripled, nonetheless, they are still levered institutions. And so that's why the regulatory focus is nearly always on them, because at the end of the day, you're protecting depositors. And that's the foundation of bank regulation. So as we've seen with the write-down of AT1s, having some institutional investors lose a bit of money, but wasn't the policymakers worried? And I think we've seen this time and time again. So I think you and I can sketch out, could there be bouts of illiquidity and what would that mean for private credit or commercial real estate? Interestingly, 60% of commercial real estate lending in the States was actually coming from the mid-cap banks, not the large banks, of what comes from banks. So I still think there's a banking channel that we should focus on. But no, look, if the market is now moving into a phase of forensically looking at balance sheet after balance sheet after balance sheet, there will be a real focus on the real estate and private equity firms to work out, are they well-funded, are they well-marked, and what's the knock? Some of my smart friends in this space are clearly looking, are there good shorts in that area?
So if you were to look at your crystal ball and think about the next few years, we've got a tightening cycle that's still ongoing. We probably are headed into recession. I would say we are headed into recession in the US. It's just a question of how severe and its duration. Would you think that there are going to be a lot more air pockets within the financial sector as a result of that trajectory?
Like you, I think we are moving to a recession. We can debate how long, depending on where monetary policy goes. But what we've seen in the past is these initial problems turn into asset quality problems as people can't roll their debts. You mentioned the S&L crisis early on. One of the phrases there was a rolling loan gathers no bad debts. And obviously, if you can't roll a loan, then that's the issue. I think around parts of private equity, parts of commercial real estate, and obviously parts of the economy where low interest rates have just allowed anyone to roll their debts, it would be gobsmacking if we don't see some asset quality problems. But going to this point, I think much more of the speculation around zero interest rates came through in the US than it did in Europe or Japan. And therefore, I think a lot more of the focus needs to be on those areas.
Which, of course, leads to the valuation question and opportunity, because it's easy to run away from wanting to own a bank stock. And yet we've got some very apparent value in the European banking space. Your former colleague, my former colleague, David Isera, has talked about UBS currently being a steal. I see Crispin Odie had taken his 2% stake yesterday. And just before this, I was reading some Bernstein research as well, where they'd taken their targets up. Generally, if you were running your own fund right now, would you be pretty excited taking a 3+ year view about the value that's there?
If we go across the stocks, I think there are a good number of opportunities. I mean, you mentioned Davide. He talked about the UBS transaction being a deal of a lifetime. Autonomous put out a 72% increase in book value for pro forma, a base case from this transaction. Well, I can't think of an M&A banking deal in history which had a 70% book value accretion. So obviously there are some interesting opportunities. I think we do need to pass the weak from the strong and play through the dynamics. As always, banks are ever a leverage play on the macro. So if we are heading into a soft recession, then that's a different scenario than a harder recession. But as I said, in Europe, I do think we've probably got a slightly softer one coming through, although you never know. I think there are some interesting opportunities here on a 3-year view. Some of the bank equities are cheap, but also, have we really discredited 81s? I mean, was this a one-off event? It's very interesting. 5 sets of regulators have come out since the weekend saying they are going to respect the hierarchy of CoCos are senior to equity. If that's the case, then the 81 asset class could also be interesting. So I think for a smart investor, there's a lot of interesting opportunities to work through.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, BordeauxIndex.com/livetrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintos. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintos is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintos and think it merits a closer look. Let's switch tack and talk about crypto. I actually don't like talking about crypto much because I'm not in the camp that thinks that I want to have it in asset allocation, but you've made the point that when Signature was rescued, the FDIC left the digital businesses to run off. Now, let's talk about that and what's going on and what's the motivation.
I'm recognised I spent 18 months serving Mark Carney, and so I might be stuck in the groupthink of central bankers all thinking that crypto is awful. I realise I've got a prior bias here. However, if you look at Silvergate and Signature's failure, it's very tough not to say that the allegations of money laundering and poor KYC weren't a material contributor to the loss of confidence and the outflow of deposits. And as you know, a couple of our mutual hedge fund friends have been short these names because of the crypto allegations. So I think if you're sitting there as the Fed as a supervisor or FIDIC as a rescuer of banks, and you see that crypto probably tripped over two banks and also probably lit the tinder to trip over the third US bank, you would be very negative on banking digital assets. So we'd already seen before this crisis a series of Wells notices, which normally mean enforcement action against firms. And we saw another one last night against Coin. But I think it's very interesting that if FIDIC say they don't want the digital asset business to be acquired by another bank, I think you're basically seeing the policymakers trying to put a choker on this. I think one or two folk have talked about this is choke point 2.0. It doesn't mean that this is the end of crypto by any means, but it means that the regulated banking system is going to be under a forensic gaze of regulators. And it going back to the Super League are going to be highly discouraged from banking any crypto. So I think it's going to make it more difficult to get your money in and out of the crypto system, at least for some time.
As the other side of that, as a longtime gold bull, without boring on the subject, I'm reminded of Ray Dalio's comment, which is that gold's attractiveness is the reciprocal of confidence in the general central banking. And so I would not be surprised to see that become more center stage as opposed to the 12,000 cryptos or a number that might be out there that are purporting to be digital gold.
But it's interesting on that. So one of the major stable coins, I'm not trying to pick on any particular name, when you look at where did they leave the money overnight, because of the regulations, the largest banks in the States were leverage constrained. They didn't want flighty deposits. So actually they turned away the stablecoin deposits. You may argue it's anti-competitive too, but it's mostly because they just didn't need those deposits. They went to the tier two banks. So if you look at where the stablecoin cash balances were, bizarrely enough, it was Silvergate, Signature, SVB, FR. So I think there's also going to be a reappraisal also of stablecoins, which is one of the routes to get money in and out of the crypto house.
Now we've seen in the UK, but elsewhere as well, the development of the neobanks, the Monzas and the Starlings and the rest of them. Where do they sit in the reordering of the banking playing field?
I think it's a great question, and I'm not sure I've got high conviction on the answer, because I think it depends by bank. Because I think what we're also learning here is banking culture really matters. Have you done your ALM and risk management and KYC really matters? So I think it's unfair to sort of pick on any one institution. One level, a rising interest rate environment means that you can get more profitability from bank. Over time, you just need to get through the speed bump of the adjustment of the interest rates. I think that you've got a couple of things, though. What you're seeing, and Simon, you've discussed this before, across the whole of the tech and the fintech world, is the profitability has to be much sharper. So everyone is now trying to, their moonshots are now looking to do shots down the M4. They're much shorter runways that they need to turn profit. So the aspiration for extraordinary growth is no longer there. But nonetheless, if they've got insured deposits, they're well managed, they can be good franchises. But I think there will be a real reassessment. And you've seen the valuation of a lot of these fintechs for, you know, 70, 80, even sometimes 90%.
Now you, I think with Mark Carney, were the author, co-author of a report on the future of finance. What would you think might be the two or three important changes over the next few years that will alter the landscape?
One would be, as money becomes ever more digital, how do we think through what a digital bank run looks like in the future? What does that mean for the way a bank thinks about liquidity and the kind of maturity and the kind of loans that it can make on those deposits? So I think there'll be a reevaluation of the kind of digital world. I think second, you have to view that there's going to be a big call to be made around what is the future of tokenization in banking. And I don't just mean crypto, that could also mean stablecoins, CBDCs, or even just simply tokenization of security asset classes. Personally, I think that the whole enthusiasm and the race towards a CBDC is going to slow. We need to really stop, reflect, think about what we've just learned, and do we really want to be giving out digital tokens backed by the central bank, which would maybe exacerbate a bank run? But I think it's a deep and difficult question. I had to do a TED talk on this last year, and I talked about that central bankers were trying to come up almost with a Goldilocks CBDC, not too much to destabilize the system, but not too little to be irrelevant and not get their boondoggles. Because to be fair, researching a CBDC has been an extraordinary opportunity, because guess where you go? You get to go to Vietnam, Bahamas, Eastern Caribbean. I mean, it's been a boondoggle for CBDC researchers. But I think that whole securitization, I think it slows. But I think around the institutional space, even when we use our Visa or MasterCard, they tokenize our transaction between you and me because they want to encrypt it. I think we will continue to need to think about enhancing that encryption, even if it may not be a digital and decentralized one. So that's the second one. And the third one, I think it does come back to the climate stuff. I think that the work that Mark kicked off, and I obviously was in the room with him around getting finance to think about climate, not only as a financial risk, but also as an opportunity, is going to continue to be a major theme. I think it's probably a more micro theme. I mean, just to give you an example, Simon, and I hope it's not too micro. When the banks looked at climate risk, they never thought that there would, let's say in Europe, be climate shocks in the coming decade. Well, last summer, we're given the droughts. I can think of at least four banks I know who are worried about farms going bust this year in Germany or Holland because of the droughts as a result of climate change. So I think there's an appreciation, but much more importantly, and I'm sorry it's a long answer, is finance is now thinking about the opportunities of marshalling money. And I think with the green subsidies, the IRA in the States and the EU plan here, if you tot it all up, something like 3 trillion of subsidies or discounted loans for a banker and financier, and let alone the central banks, that's something one has to get behind.
So I'm struck that our conversation's focused on the US and Europe, and it's left out that huge chunk, which is Asia. What are the observations one make about the Asian financial system, big domestic institutions, population growth, etc.? Are they learning anything from this and trying to do it differently? Or, you know, should we be thinking about the opportunities set there as investors?
Going back into 2008, I always found it fascinating that for the West, a bank run was a surprise. So for the Bank of England, it was the first since 1865. However, there's been, if you take the IMF database since 1972, I think there's been 170-ish systemic banking crises around the world. We don't learn from the emerging markets. But in our lifetime, of course, we have had in Korea and Indonesia and beyond major banking panics. As a result, their kind of FX mismatch is way lower. The liquidity management is better. So I don't think they're seeing the same stresses that we are at the moment, although I still think this nature of a digital bank run is something we worry about. So I think the nature of the excesses and mismatches is always where one should focus. Obviously, China is in a different camp. There are some state-run banks there, which obviously have got a series of bad debts, which they're chomping through. But if I think about the private sector banks, whether it be the Singaporeans or the Australians, they look in somewhat better shape for the moment. But look, you know, like everything in life, one needs to think about the individual bank, not just the system.
You are vice chair at Oliver Wyman. Tell me a little bit about how you, as a firm, and you, because you're called upon to do lots of things, operate with clients.
It's a fantastic firm. Its heritage is very much sort of technical and risk for financial services. That's the background. And you may remember at Morgan Stanley, Oliver Wyman and Morgan Stanley used to write a joint report, which Davide and I were on the one side of. So I think they've got an extraordinary knowledge and technical know-how around financial services. But over the last 20 years, they've obviously grown into many other sectors. So I think they get very heavily called upon by large institutions to help them think through difficult, complex problems to solve and try to have the technical know-how to do it. So I think it's a very exciting place. Part of my role is to work with clients, but also I'm doing quite a lot of research as well, bringing on my kind of investment analyst heritage as well.
Going back to that climate question, we had Nikolai Tangen as a guest the year before. Absolutely fantastic guest. And my gosh, as you know him well, just inspiring individual. And you're working with Norges Bank on the Climate Advisory Board. Tell us a little bit about what you and he are hoping to achieve.
Nikolai and then the Norges Bank itself wants to be a world leader in thinking about investing in the energy transition around the world. I think there's sort of three blocks to that. The first is obviously understanding investment risks. Where there is energy transition or climate change, what does that mean for a portfolio? Particularly for a fund which is the largest investor in the world. They own 3% of most European companies and about 1.4% of every US company. They're thinking about very long-dated risks. So they really want to understand, what does 21st century risks mean to companies they are a custodian of? Second is to seek out the opportunities. Who can be the biggest investor in climate tech? Who could be the biggest investor in the solutions and opportunities around this? And the third, to be honest, I think this is where Nikolai and Karina are very inspirational, is can there be a standard setter? And this is the really tricky one. As a sovereign wealth fund, most SWF sovereign wealth funds, as you know, want to keep a little bit below the radar because of their political influence. But because they are an arm's length body, they also want to be involved in standard setting bodies to really enhance the disclosure so that the investment community can make better informed risks. So I think it's a very inspiring mandate. And he's very kindly invited myself and three others to try and join a climate advisory board to think through not just the plan they've got, but how each and every year can they get that little bit shrewder and savvier around the investment risks and opportunities, or how can they actually improve the standards in the market? All credit to Nikolai and team.
We're staying with interesting folks. Sandra Robertson, who is the CIO at Oxford University Endowment Management, you know well. So we did have a sneaky little moment to say what would be the question that she'd want to ask you to make sure that you weren't entirely comfortable today. And she said, so if you had $100 billion to invest in the climate transition, how would you allocate it and what percentage return would you require?
I think this is both a really important, but actually quite a difficult question. Where are the opportunities? So look, first, climate tech, climate solutions are incredibly exciting opportunity areas. And they're very broad. I mean, this is from AI to optimize how a grid is run, through to data standards, you know, the MSCIs and the other data carriers of the world, through to, quite frankly, carbon capture. This is an area full of opportunity, remains still relatively capital light, so you can get teens-like returns. I mean, there is a lot of money trying to chase this, but I think that's the area which the climate solutions really has to be the standout and category one to put your money. Second is what I think of as like the industry leaders. How is McDonald's changing the agriculture value chain? How is Microsoft changing the tech value chain? These leaders can have disproportionate influence on the emissions of not only themselves, but the entire industry. Again, getting behind these leaders and helping empower them to do that is very exciting, probably more in a public market equity portfolio. Now, here's a tricky bit. Ideally, we'd want to put a ton of money behind renewables. But capital-intensive renewables have got a shockingly bad return on investment at the moment. If you want to go and invest around, I don't know, an offshore wind farm at the moment in Europe, you're probably going to get 3% to 4% returns on capital. That's not what an endowment, a family office, pension fund typically wants to have. It's probably more for an insurer. It's more the legal and general type returns. And that's the tragedy, because that's where the money is needed. Because the challenge to national security from the Ukrainian war and beyond is we now need more energy independence. So there are plenty of subsidies going into renewables. And I think we therefore need to think about pre-subsidy, that 3% to 4% just isn't enough. But can it be supercharged, or can you get behind the benefit of those subsidies would be a question I'd want to do the investment work on. But I think it's tough to put a lot of your $100 billion into that only to get 3% given inflation is still rampant. And then last, the improvers. If you go back to the modeling of how emissions fall, half of the emissions falling is companies going from gray to green. It's getting Solvay to reduce its emissions and become a cleaner company. It's getting Volkswagen to go from dirty to green. I think the improvers have got a little bit of a bad rep because at the moment, that's where the emissions are. And I think what a lot of the NGO community have got wrong is it's not just about reducing financed emissions, it's about financing emissions reduction. We need to help those improvers get better. And I think that grey to green opportunity is a huge one. And I think that's one of the more exciting ones, both for private market opportunities as well as for public. So as ever, an investment question like this, if Sandra doesn't know the answer, it must be bloody complicated.
Well, I didn't, which is why I asked the question. But also, we've had a lot of conversation on the show, but also on our second channel, the Curator channel. We did one with TechMet, Technology Metals, run by Brian Mendel, where, of course, the irony is that to be able to facilitate all of this, a lot of stuff's going to be pulled out of the ground even before Ukraine has to be rebuilt. That might offer some really quite attractive returns. However, distasteful at one level, it might seem to people who don't want to pursue that.
I think BlackRock's got 42 ESG ETFs. And obviously, the ESG backlash means some of the early ones have struggled because they are too broad an index. But the latest one they've just filed is a rare earths ETF for exactly that reason, because that's where a lot of the opportunity may lie.
Well, I'm smiling because we had scheduled the head of BlackRock's ETF business to come out on Thursday, but he's just now been pushed back because we have you. So Salim Ramji, who runs the passive business, is on and has a great conversation about passive. It puts me in my place on a number of things where I was wrong, but really, really interesting about the ETFs, particularly actually in the fixed income space. Hugh, let's just talk about some general things. I'm struck by the fact that you've been, over the years that I've known you, a great thinker and writer and speaker, and you're being called upon to do a lot, particularly right now. How do you make time to think?
So first is you have to be really hypothesis-led. Second, I do try and make sure I've got time to mug up on the past. So I'm afraid even with the fall of the banks for the last two weekends, I'm afraid I downloaded again, the best way to rob a bank is to own one. I also downloaded another book. I think history is so important because of the rhyme. One thing I'm afraid I do is I have a phony meeting in my diary for an hour and a half a day. Now, probably I shouldn't have said that now because my colleagues now know. But I put in a phony meeting to try and make sure I've got a block of 90 minutes or 2 hours where I can actually think or read or research. It's tricky because it is relentless. And sometimes, like our good hedge fund friends and investing friends, sometimes some of that thinking time is going for a walk on the weekend as well.
Of those strands, you said I'm hypothesis-led. Can you just explain or illustrate what that means?
The easiest example would be, if this really has become a bank run of the billionaires, who else looks like has got billionaire clients? Now, that's a very obvious one. But it's looking for those fact patterns and repetitions to see who may look similar, who may look dissimilar. So as a research analyst, I would always encourage my team to actually write the first page of the research before they've done any homework. And then they go off and then try and work out, well, was I right? Was I wrong? And actually test that argument. But I think you've got to be led by a thesis.
More generally, what's on the Hugh Van Steenis list of yet to be accomplished?
I remain passionate about markets and the investing world. So for me, the key thing is to keep joining up the dots between my small amount of know-how and where the opportunities are. And I've been blessed to have opportunities to serve with Mark Carney, but obviously more recently with Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, Oxford, and Laura Wyman. I'm just keen to keep joining up the dots between markets and ideas and capital.
And if we could set up a dinner for you to sit with two of the great finance people, or investors, folks from the present or the past, who would they be?
That's a very good question. I haven't thought about that at all. So I am passionate about Keynes and what I've learned from reading him. I know it's hideously obvious, but he nailed it on so many ways. In fact, and I'm going to misquote him now, but he said something like, the sound banker is someone who would rather fail conventionally. And I think that's right. If I look at Silicon Valley Bank, they didn't want to look atypical. When they failed conventionally. So I think Keynes is just rich and thoughtful and interesting. Through Morgan Stanley, I was blessed to meet some of the most extraordinary minds. So I met Stan Drunkmiller and so forth. I used to very kindly go and have lunch with George Soros at his townhouse in London. But if I have to say, I'd love to carry on talking to George, because I think his understanding of the macro and translating that through into trades and micro was extraordinary. And also to think about risk appetite. When you've got hot hands, when do you really go for it and when do you not? Effectively, as a banks analyst, I'm looking at macro through a micro lens. And I think George, in some ways, personifies what makes a good banks investor.
And what would you tell a 20-year-old Hugh?
I definitely would encourage them to read financial history. My good friend Neil Ferguson has a line that he wishes that more central bankers had read history rather than doing a PhD in economics. And I'm sure that's right. So having a really good list of financial history from, I don't know, what happened in the Weimar Republic, Adam Ferguson's brilliant book, Where Money Dies, through to what happened more recently. So one is financial history. Second, of course, get the technical skills, but I'm sure that many of them program and code. And a third is just be voracious in listening to the signals. Could be just subscribing to The Economist. These days, you can get a retail access to Bloomberg quite cheaply. That's phenomenal too. And obviously, of course, listen to your podcast.
God, I didn't even prompt you. That's fantastic. Thank you. Well, Hugh, this has been terrific. And I really appreciate, we all appreciate you coming in a very busy schedule to talk to us and to lay some stuff out on the table that is not obvious to many people, however much they might be professional investors. So thank you very much. We always take away a couple of things, or I try to summarize. My goodness, I wrote down a lot today. But I like your last comment, perhaps because all those years ago, I studied economic history, but read financial history. And Neil Ferguson was one of our top guests, as you might remember, and we hopefully can have him back later in the year. And in this whole energy transition, the opportunities are not altogether clear, but financing emission reduction and that focus on the companies that are deemed maybe to be the polluters or the non-greens that are in that transition is perhaps where a lot of the investment opportunity lies. And I think that's still being explored. So, Hugh, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much.
Oh, Simon, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.